Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
Now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage. You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
If you watch Brotherhood on Showtime, many of you don't know what I'm talking about. It's a pretty graphic illustration of what politics really comes down to. It's buying and selling and buying and selling and selling and buying. So now listen to Scott Brown about his phone call with President Obama and tell me what you think. Clip one first.
He called. He was called right away, which I thanked him for. And we were talking, and he said, you know, I look forward to meeting you and having an opportunity to work with you. And he said, I heard that you are open-minded and you're kind of an independent guy. And I said, well, Mr. President, I want to meet you, too. You have a wonderful family. I've always had great respect for your accomplishments. And, by the way, do you want me to bring the truck? I did say that, and he laughed. He says, well, you know, when I came down there, I didn't, you know, go at you too hard.
All right. Very nice so far. Very gentlemanly. Now the next one.
And I said, well, all kidding aside, I do have a basketball player daughter, and I know you play a lot of hoop. And I'd love to, you pick your best, and I'll take Ayler, and we'll play you 2-on-2, and he laughed again. I said, you know what, Mr. President, regardless of, you know, we may not agree on some things, but you have a sense of humor, and you have to have a sense of humor about politics.
Now already, here it comes. We may not agree on some things. You catch that? That's not even day one. Many of you thought he disagreed with Obama on everything, that he was the Messiah. You thought he was the Obama of the right. He had an opportunity, and he blew it. Did you hear what I just said? Scott Brown has already blown his chances to ignite America and to get them behind him. Don't you hear? I mean, I'm the first because many of you are kind of sighing with relief, but you didn't listen. You didn't actually hear the man or the politician. You didn't hear him at all. You just said, wow, he won and the world's safe now. The world's safe for democracy. No, what you had there was a milquetoast guy saying he had a milquetoast conversation with the president, and they can't wait to play some hoops together. What he should have done, in my opinion, was gotten up there with fire and brimstone. He didn't have to be hateful about it. He doesn't work for MSNBC. He could have been strong without being hateful. He's not a talk radio host. He doesn't work for television. He could have retained his dignity, and he could have been strong. And he could have said, I was elected. I am so glad that I talked with the president. I can't wait to meet him and tell him why we must defeat socialized medicine. I can't wait to tell him why in Massachusetts we've had such a terrible experience with illegal aliens and he must not push forward legalizing illegal aliens. I can't wait to meet the president off the basketball court so I can say to him why cap and trade is not only foolish financially or economically rather, but it is also based upon false science. And I can also say to the president, trying Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and other terrorists who killed so many in civilian court while persecuting so many military members such as Lieutenant Behenna is a travesty, and it's why America is angry at politicians. And so, therefore, I cannot wait to meet you, Mr. President. Now that, my friends, would have been cause to celebrate. That would have been hopeful. That would have given you change, the kind of change that you were looking for. But please, slow down. Slow down, take a deep breath. 8 years in the Massachusetts state political machine. Either watch Brotherhood or go watch The Departed just to get a flavor of what we are talking about. A flavor, I said. I didn't imply he's corrupt in any way. He is a politician. If you really are serious, read Machiavelli, Prince Machiavelli. Now let's play a little rock and roll. It's Rock and Roll Friday on the Savage Nation.
At the hop, 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 hop.
Guy's a Lieutenant Colonel in the National Guard. You know, I'll take a chance on him. As I said to you, don't Obama eyes Scott Brown. I'm the first to say it. I won't be the last. The good, interesting thing about being a leader in any field is that the others only get to look at your posterior when you're the leader. So the fact of the matter is, you're Obama-sizing Scott Brown, and you're going to be disappointed. He is not the Messiah of the right. Just as the left thought Obama is the Messiah. Don't go for it. Doesn't mean he's a bad guy. He's going to give you probably maybe 55-60% of what you want. But 40% of the things Brown does will disappoint the right wing in this country. He's going to compromise. He's been in power a long time. He knows what the political game is like. I just hope that on national security, he becomes the toughest guy in the country, in the Congress. Because we certainly need someone other than the dunces that we have now. Can you imagine anything more absurd than Dianne Feinstein as the chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee? Can you imagine a left-wing gun grabber being in charge of U.S. intelligence, and you wonder why the Muslims are able to infiltrate airplanes and the military? You don't have to look any further than Dianne Feinstein sitting as the chairwoman. Will the honorable chairwoman please get off the whoopee cushion and tell us her opinion of the State of the Union with regard to national security? I certainly will. Shopping carts and more shopping carts are the only thing that can save us from this threat of global warming. In fact, if a shopping cart was given to every person on Earth that was provided by my husband, I'm convinced that global warming would be lessened by 10% a year for the next 10 years, reducing it to zero over 100 years if we're only you'd buy shopping carts for every man, woman, and child in Calcutta. Well, of course, I'm being facetious. Because sometimes I like to get facetious and have a little fun. But we need real leadership. We need gutsy men who have been in the military to take over these intelligence agencies or we're cooked, we're dead. We need men who have faced the enemy and had the guts to shoot them in the face without consulting a book on what they can do. They're the only ones who can save us. Do you ever see Carl Levin? Have you ever seen him? The guy who tries to be Daniel Webster with eyeglasses on his nose? Carl Levin! Schmendrick Carl Levin! With eyeglasses on his nose, thinking he looks ministerial. He looks like a putz. The guy looks like he worked as a presser in the garment center. He's another one atop of the intelligence heap, Carl Levin. Now, if you were in a cave somewhere trying to kill Americans, would you be frightened if you saw Carl Levin or Dianne Feinstein or that other sham from San Diego, the former mayor of San Diego, that other one? She looks hysterical every time they talk about guns and the military. Jane Harmon, another one. You look at these people, I can't believe this is why, I can't believe how you can't put two and two together, which is why things are happening like airplanes and guys' crotches catching on fire and Major Hassan being bounced up the chain of command, even though he was screaming Muslim this, Allah that, the war is illegal, signing reports with Allah be praised on them. Can you imagine if an army psychiatrist wrote Jesus be praised? Do you think they would have moved them up the chain of command and moved them down to Texas to Fort Hood? I kind of don't think so. But this guy was writing Allah be praised on psychiatric reports. And they still promoted him out of fear of the ACLU, the most subversive group America has ever seen. I stand by those words. Until those rats, those pockmarked rats, are rounded up. But if you think that the senior operatives in our defense and intelligence agencies don't know that what I'm saying is true, you are mistaken. It's the people above them who are destroying this country. Take a look at the CIA under that laughingstock. The Peter Sellers lookalike. I can't even remember his name. Pancetta. Leon Pancetta. Sounds like a dish, not like a leader. But it would be bad enough if that was a joke. Leon Panetta lets 7 CIA agents get blown up and no one gets fired for that misstep. Janet Napolitano lets a guy get on an airplane from Nigeria to Amsterdam with a one-way ticket with no luggage, without a U.S. passport, and she says that everything worked fine, the system worked fine. Well, it worked fine because there was a Flying Dutchman. That's why. He's still yet to be given a Presidential Medal of Freedom instead of some perverted nut that wrote a bad poem being invited to the White House. But you see, the people in the agencies actually know the danger, and they know what needs to be done, but they're controlled by the Napolitanos, they're controlled by Leon Panetta, they're controlled by Feinstein, they're controlled by Carl Levin. Listen to this clip, for example, of a man who apparently knows what he's doing. He's the intelligence director, Dennis Blair, at a Senate Homeland Security Committee hearing expressing disappointment over intelligence leaks.
The unauthorized leaks of the NSA intercepted this, or a CIA human report said this, or this airport is good, or that, I think are just making the job of those who are working hard to try to defend us that much harder. It costs the taxpayer that much more money, and I wish people would just shut the hell up.
God bless him. Now, who do you think he was referring to when he said, I wish they would just shut the hell up? I think he was referring to people like the ACLU, ABC, CBS, NBC, and the others. Don't you? I kind of think that. I'm such an obsessive when it comes to food. You know that already. Everything has to be a meal and a special and a preparation. Because I'm getting fed up. I mean, I'll give you an example. I went to one restaurant. I go to it a lot. Not on Fisherman's Wharf. Not the place I love. I'll say it's in Marin County. Okay? Just so you know. I order a minestrone soup. The broth tasted simply like hot water. Okay? With like a cube in it. And none of the vegetables were cooked. What is this with not cooking a vegetable in minestrone soup? Who would have eaten this in the years gone by? Nobody. An Italian grandmother would have thrown it out off a fire escape. Let's say you were a kid and she said, all right, make a minestrone soup, and you didn't cook the vegetables, and it was just like hot water. She'd throw it out of the window that they served that in a restaurant. You know, every minute, senor this and senor that and this and the oil and the bread, but the food you can puke from. So I stopped already. That's why I'm eating granola now and fresh fruit. Fresh fruit. It's horrible. I don't understand this. Play music for me now. I feel I'm spacing out. Give me some rock. That's nice. What is this? Oh, the Sea of Love.
The Sea of Love.
Who's Bill Phillips? Who's Bill Phillips? Who was the girl actor, the woman actress in this movie with Al Pacino? She was still good looking when they did the movie. Ellen Barkin, whatever happened to her? I often think about, she's still operating somewhere? She's trying to nail another Madoff like guy like that. She always marries like, perfume magnates or whatever. All right, turn it off. Headache already, migraine. I got to tell you what happened. I'm going to back off into a personal now. Forgive me my personal indulgences every once in a while. You're not going to believe this. Remember I was complaining about ears, humming in my ears for a couple of days. Really, it was like I was inside a swimming pool. You know, like that? Like something over your ears? Okay, I had that for days. So I go to an ear doctor, and he looks in my ears, and he takes the opportunity to clean my ears, which was disgusting. I didn't ask him to clean them. I just look at him to see what's in these. He says, well, while I'm in there, and he pulled out wax that looked like I'm sorry to bore you, it looked like the size of a small fly. So I said, that's what caused the humming? He said, no, but I couldn't see beyond it. Now that I can, there's nothing wrong with you. So I said, okay, great. All right, so you go home. I relaxed on a four-day weekend. I took time off from radio, and it went away. It truly did. It was all tension. It was nerves, right? Something happened inside me. Nerves do get to you with what I've been through from the lib attacks. Wait a minute. I swear as God is my witness, you should be struck dead by lightning if I'm lying, as they used to say in Brooklyn, even though I'm from the Bronx. You should be struck dead by lightning, not me if I'm lying. But anyway, it's an old bad joke. I swear, last night, 10:30, 11 o'clock, it was a sort of like hot night out here in California. I go out to walk the dog, and there were like moths. It was so hot, like moths were flying out of the shrubbery next to the front door. It was like eerie. And one of them, I bend down to put the leash on the dog. A moth flies in my left ear. I swear to God, there's a moth. Like, did you ever get a moth in you and try to get it out and it won't come out? And you grab it and you can't grab nothing? Nothing. Can't grab anything. and it's flapping its damn wings, and I'm freaking that it's going to burrow into my brain, I swear to God. And I'm digging and nothing's coming. I'm saying, God, why are you doing this to me? What's the message? Why is there a moth in my ear? I swear to God. And I'm digging and pulling, and I say, I got it, nothing. And it's still flipping, flapping these big wings inside my ear, and I'm freaking it's going to go in. Oh, God. Darn, and I don't see. I'm pulling and yanking, and I'm throwing on the ground, and I look, and there's nothing on the ground. So I got a freak show. I get the cell phone number of the ear doctor. I call him, and he was nice enough to take the call. I told him what happened. I said, I don't see the moth parts on the ground, but it's not flapping in my ear anymore. I said, could it get in my head and penetrate my brain? He said, no, it can't. Well, I got to tell you the truth. I mean, I put a Q-tip in there. There was a teeny bit of blood. I'm not trying to, like, gross you out here. So wait a minute. Now I put the whole thing aside, and I said, you know what? God's speaking to me. I'm a highly educated man, but, and there's a big but, I'm extremely mystically oriented about events. I still have, like, a primitive part of me that is a mystical streak, like dream interpretation. I guess that's from the hippie days, the searching for the plants, living in the Fiji Islands, drinking Yangona until all hours of the night, and you know, Amdo, and drinking with the Fijians and sitting on floor mats and seeing spirits and talking to spirit healers. But I didn't get it from that. I had it earlier than that. I had the spirit thing back in Harlem when I went to all black Abyssinian churches, and I was the only white guy because I used to like to get into the spirit of the thing. And I felt the spirit more there than I did in the Episcopal Church or the synagogue. So what can I tell you? There's always been something spirits. So therefore, I said to myself after the moth experience in the ear, what is God telling me? Why is God doing this to me? What is the meaning of a losing my hearing like in a drum last week, and this week a moth flying? And it's like one in a billion that this would happen to me. How could a moth get in my ear, and why? God's telling me something. Now, I know what it is. I have very, very strong suspicion about what it is, but I can't tell you. So I'll be right back.
Do you remember when we met? That's the day I knew.
Savage. Visit TRNCentral.com, your one stop for news and all things talk radio. That's TRNCentral.com. You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
Devil or angel, I can't make up my mind. Which one you are, I'd like to wake up and find.
I slept good last night. I don't know about you. Nightmares like every other night. I actually look forward to them. People, I don't go to horror movies because I have every night is a horror movie for me. No, I look forward to sleeping because it's incredibly interesting. Wish there were like electrodes and wires I could attach to like a camcorder that would record what I dream. I wouldn't ever have to like get up in the morning. I mean, I could just run it all day. Just broadcast it on my website. I've had zillions of listeners for that one. I forgot what last night's dream. I don't remember it all. Just the moth in the ear freaked me out. I slept like a baby. I don't know. I don't understand it. I'm very resilient. I get knocked down. I get depressed, and I get up again, and I'm stronger, because it's the beautiful part about being an immigrant son. Whatever happens to you in this country, in this life, is nothing compared to what went on in your ancestors' times in Europe. Nothing. This is nothing. You know, it's really nothing. I mean, you add up the whole picture of your life. Earwax? This I got to take. I knew it. 1-800-449-8. I can't believe it. Sacramento, KSTE Country. Lance, welcome to the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
Dr. Savage, this is the moth in your ear speaking. Now, how soon will Steven Spielberg move to Cuba to enjoy Fidel's healthcare paradise?
There you go.
I'm not yet ready to love Fidel's revolution.
Oh, he's probably going to do the Lenny Riefenstahl of Fidel.
There was a World War II pilot, but my father was only a co-pilot seated to the pilot's right.
How could a boy whose father was a pilot in World War II, how could he wind up being such a commie? No answer. All right. Medford, Oregon. Michael, welcome to the Savage Nation. Topic, please.
It is an honor and a pleasure.
Thank you. That is so nice to hear. That made me feel good today. What's on your mind?
Part of the reason why you have earwax is to keep bugs out.
I know. And when he pulled it out, I said, wait, doctor, before you pull it out, all my life I've been told don't remove the earwax. It's a protectant. You know what he said to me? He said you need a thin film of wax, not a plug. Is that true?
Well, that's what I remember from high school biology.
Well, he's the ear expert, so I didn't argue with him. I don't like it because I told him, here's the thing is, this is gory. I just got to get it over with. When I was 5 years old, again, it goes back to my fear of doctors and my distrust of the medical establishment. My mother, God rest her soul, made a few errors. One of them was she took me to a quack there, Dr. K. I can't mention his name because his family could sue me yet. One of them could be a lawyer. They went in for some reason or other. And, you know, there he's looking in my ear. All of a sudden, I was little. She was big. She held me down. Get him now, she said. Get him now. He's squirming. Get him now. And while I'm down, they had a tube in my ear with water squirted in and stuff came out. And I said, what did they do that to me for? I never trusted my mother or a doctor ever since. Now, what they did was they took the earwax out. I was told years later they never should have done that. You got to leave the earwax in. Why? What do you remove the wax for?
Well, like I said, you know, from high school biology, I remember that.
Right. I said earwax the same thing. So here it is. A week later, a bug goes for it. All right, let me send you a free copy of what? Band and earwax?
Well, are you writing on that yet?
No, I have not written band and earwax yet. if you can name the book, you'll get a free copy. Band in?
I'm sorry, band in England.
That's right. Banned in Britain. You get a free copy. Stay in the line. God forbid he almost said banned in Ireland. Oh, I'm not banned in Ireland. I'm going to Ireland, I think. I feel like, you know, in the Midnight Cowboy, it's like going to Florida. Like, remember, you wanted to go to Florida, the land of sunshine and orange juice. The moth in the ear scares me a little bit. I'll tell you why. Because I don't know if I got it out. I don't feel anything. But I have a Stephen King nightmare now. Like, the moth is in there. It's laying eggs. Larvae are going to grow, and they're going to come out of my ears and eyes and your nose, like, in months to come. Nah, come on. I mean, this is paranoiacville. Barbara, Wisconsin, welcome to the program.
Hi. I want to tell you about my husband's story with a moth.
Oh, God.
One flew in his ear one night, and so I called the emergency in our area. And they told me to have my husband go in a dark room, put a flashlight in the ear, and the moth came right flying out of his ear.
Oh, my God. Like a fool went right to sleep in a dark bed. It probably burrowed into my ear.
Yes.
Oh, my God. That's an A. So the moth, yeah, but I probably killed it, I would think, because I was digging while it was flipping.
My husband was doing that, too, and he said he could feel it inside his head.
Oh, stop. Don't. This could turn into something nightmarish. Now I have to see the ear guy over the weekend. Just what I needed. Again. All right. Thanks for the call. God. I got to tell you, you know, let me go back for it. Can I take a deep breath? Go one, two, three. Breathe in, breathe out, breathe in, breathe out. Oh, that feels good, man. That's good. I just took a toke of the O2. It feels good. I got to tell you. Every time I go to a restaurant, I ask them, can I have a dish for Teddy? And he brings me out water like, you know, Hetch Hetchy 09. And I said, that's my dog, champagne. Bring me a glass of that, too. You know, that costs nothing. I don't even drink bottled water anymore. It's just like Hetch Hetchy with ice. My favorite new drink. If it works for my dog, it must work for me. I'm not saying I'm ready to try the dog food, but I'm telling you the truth. There's a little crossover here. The dog food I give him is more or less what I eat anyway. I mean, I went to a restaurant, got him a hamburger. There's a double reason I give him a hamburger before I order. Why? Because what I order takes, like, in a certain restaurant I go to, it's like 20 minutes till they make the beef bourguignon, or 20 minutes for this. Meanwhile, the dog's hamburger, no salt and pepper, comes out in 3 minutes, and I eat half of it. It's like an appetizer. What could be better? It's like having a child. There are advantages to having a child. You get to eat candy, which you don't eat anymore. You get to act like an idiot running around. You're walking on all fours on the floor. That's the beauty of having children and grandchildren, is you can become a child again. And that's the beauty of having a dog, is you can start you can get away with things like ordering a hamburger before the meal for the dog and eat half of it. What does he know? He's only 10 pounds. Now, don't think I'm ripping off my dog's food by doing it. Let me explain something to you. If he weighs 10 pounds, just do math with me. If you can still do math in your head, I only do math, man. I taught myself never to use a computer for math, which is why no one can rob me of money. I don't need to go to a digital calculator. My brain was built way back in the HAL 9000 days in the Bronx, where I had to memorize mathematical tables. But I don't need a calculator to do simple math. So my dog weighs 10 pounds. And let's say, I don't want to give too much away, I weigh 170. Argument's sake, that's what I'm now. Around, no, 160. I don't know what I, no, 170. Okay, I can't lie. So the dog's 10, I'm 170. So I'm 17 times heavier than the dog, right? So here's the short answered question for the math test. If I give the dog a quarter pound burger, what is that equivalent in meat to a 170 pound man? That's ridiculous, like eating a horse. So he doesn't eat a quarter pound burger. He'll eat like a python until he explodes. So I have to like calculate backwards and give him 1/11 of what I'm giving him. You don't give him a man sized hamburger, and this restaurant doesn't give him a quarter pounder. This guy, he's an old friend of mine. He's a Basque guy, and he gives him a burger. Oh, you pay for it. What's the difference? But no, it's a nice piece of meat. This is no leftover. This is not from Walmart, from the meat that fell underneath when the holiday ended under the truck while the guy was off on a vacation and it rolled over in the sun a few times and actually started to run away from the meat packet. It's not that kind of meat. We're talking about a grade A hamburger, you know? So let's say you take, what, he's giving me a half of him? No, it couldn't be a half. A third of a pound of meat. Now I'm going to get complicated. If a dog weighs 10 pounds and a man weighs 170 pounds and he gives him a third of a pound of a hamburger, and he gets a third of a pound of a hamburger on the table, what size hamburger should he give the dog to make certain that the dog doesn't drop dead of a heart attack?
Savage.
Let me give you another lesson in what's going on in your country right in front of your eyes. It's happening in front of your eyes. And they're distracting you with the healthcare lie, or this, you're for it, you're against it, single payer, double payer, triple payer, all aboard. That's not what you should be paying attention to. It's far deeper than healthcare. Healthcare, of course, is a very big part of communist revolutions around the world. And one of the first things Fidel Castro did after promising healthcare to the Cubans was, in fact, deliver healthcare, the worst amongst the worst in the Western Hemisphere. It's on the par of about Haiti. Haitian health care is about equal to Cuban health care. Ask any of the elites in Cuba who go to Miami for a Jewish doctor whenever they really need health care. They certainly don't use a doctor with a dirty smock and no medicine in Havana. So they're deceiving you by taking your eye off the ball. While you're watching the health care debate and you think that it's all about that, they have infiltrated every avenue of this government. It's my job to give you lessons in deceit and how the Communist Party USA has actually taken over America, either knowingly or unknowingly. It doesn't matter whether the Communist Party CPUSA took over America. They may as well have taken over America. Now, infiltration is an important phrase that you have to understand. It's one of the oldest techniques of communist tactics. Infiltration was advocated by Lenin and Stalin. I'm going to read you something now that was exhorted by George Dimitrov, General Secretary before the 7th World Congress of the Communist International. You're not going to hear this on Fox News. One paragraph. Comrades, you remember the ancient tale of the capture of Troy. Troy was inaccessible to the armies attacking her, thanks to her impregnable walls. And the attacking army, after suffering many sacrifices, was unable to achieve victory until, with the aid of the famous Trojan horse, it managed to penetrate to the very heart of the enemy's camp. Dimitrov said that Homer's famous story must be applied to the 20th century. He went on to say, "We should not be shy about using the same tactics. The Trojan horse must be used by the party." And my friends, would you agree with me that the Trojan horse has now entered the gates? Who listening to this show can argue, after hearing the White House communications czar Anita Dunn praising Mao Zedong, that I am wrong to be the Paul Revere of our time in warning you that we're far down the path of an absolute and total takeover? Anybody want to argue with that one? Michael in Spain, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Hello, Michael. Thanks for giving all the supporters out there strength to fight this liberal agenda. I'm in probably the worst socialist country in the world, Spain, headed by Jose Luis Zapatero. He's got the political savvy of Gavin Newsom, only worse.
Well, here's the thing about Spain. It was a very fine government ruling it until the subways were bombed by the Muslims within. And let's not mince words. Muslims bombed the subways, and immediately the people capitulated. The Spanish lost their guts to fight. Isn't that true?
Absolutely. I was here when it happened. And, yeah, they
I mean, the Spanish have gone from the conquistadors in stainless steel or metal suits to what are they disco kings now?
No, just skinny socialists, you know, with their designer jeans, skinny arm vegetarian types with their little glasses, you know, they try to look like a Woody Allen, you know.
Oh, they're trying to have a low profile, keep their head down.
Yeah, he's a hero over here. They have statues of that pedophile over here.
Of Michael Jackson?
No, Woody Allen.
Oh, Woody Allen is a hero in Spain?
You can't believe it. You can't believe it.
That's a strange one. From a country that gave us the Inquisition to suddenly pick up on Woody Allen, that's a pretty big jump. I mean, that was a nation that invented the term Marrano. You know what that is, don't you?
No, what?
The Marranos were Jews in the Middle Ages who were forced to convert to Catholicism. Otherwise, they would be tortured and killed. So many of them, on the surface, converted into Catholicism, but they practiced the religion under the surface. That they were called Marranos.
There's another term for them. But you got to remember that there are a bunch of apologizing sad sacks now. You know, they apologize for being conquistadores. They apologize for the Inquisition. They're always apologizing for the Franco years, which by the way, he saved 60,000 Jews. He allowed them into the country because he knew Hitler.
That's right. I know the whole story of the Spanish Civil War. Most of the Americans that went over in the Abraham Lincoln Brigade were diehard anti-American communists. They should have been thrown out of the country before they went into the Abraham Lincoln Brigade. I actually met a few of those old rotten people in North Beach in the early days. So what are you doing stuck in the Iberian Peninsula?
Well, you know, I'm teaching English over here, so I can't find work in America for the last 7 or 8 years.
So you're sort of an illegal immigrant in Spain, in Andalusia. You're in the new Andalusia. You know Andalusia, of course, as a teacher, what that is.
Yes, Al Andalus. That's what they used to call
it. That's right. Have they changed the name of Spain to Andalus yet? To placate the Moors amongst them?
Well, they're trying to get rid of their patron saint, Santiago, who's the patron saint of Moor slayers. I mean, they're trying to get rid of any type of religion here, like they did back in the Republic, by the way.
Well, the communists have long wanted to get rid of the church, and now they're doing it through political correctness.
Absolutely. And, you know, they got rid of it during the Republic, and that's why the Republic failed. You know, the whole idea of socialism, and you've said it, we all say it, it's about getting rid of foundations to destroy the society. So you're just relying on the government. That's it.
That's right. The new religion is the state. The new Messiah is the head of the state. That is why Obama is worshipped as a head of state. Because they've turned him into God. They've made him into a substitute for Jesus. Do you understand that?
Yeah, absolutely.
That's right. In other words, the Christian should worship Obama instead of worshiping Jesus, because Obama represents not the church, but the state. That's what communism is.
Absolutely. And I mean, you just see it. I mean, Europe is just going down the tubes. I mean, it's like...
Oh, wait a minute. The radical Muslims went down into the tubes and bombed it with some compound. I don't think that Alfred Nobel invented. They didn't use TNT.
They used plastic explosives. But now this is, yeah, you can't believe the overrunning of people from South America, Eastern Europe, Africa, North Africa, Senegal.
But is there a right-wing party in Spain that is nationalistic, that would like to see the glory of the days of the great Spain restored? Is there such a group left in that country?
Absolutely. There's a few of them left, but they got to be careful. They can't display, they can't display certain insignias. You can't go on Franco's birthday up to where he's buried and do certain things or say certain things. They're watching. They're filming you. I've been to Franco's.
So in other words, the leftists have turned it into a police state, a fascist police state.
Absolutely.
It's the new Soviet. It's the new Soviet Union with paella. Instead of serving borscht, they serve paella.
Absolutely.
Hey, how is the paella in Spain these days? Is it any good?
It depends on where you go. You know, if you go to certain places, they make it right. If you go to, like, a tourist place, it's complete crap. If you make it at home, you know, because they got all the components to make it with.
I make the best paella in the world. I do, because I use expensive saffron to begin with. Most paella, by the way, since we're talking about cuisine, I can't help it because I lived in Spain for a while, a very brief period. I really love the food. I actually lived in Mallorca, Arenal de Mallorca, and I used to eat in a local little restaurant. I think it was 30 pesetas for lunch. It was unbelievable. Most paella is made not with saffron, but with a cheaper substitute, which simply colors the food rather than flavors it, number one. And number two, they over-oil it. They don't cook it long enough to create that slight crust on the bottom because they're anxious to get it out of the oven. And it's too filled with butter to have a proper taste.
When I've made it before, I mean, you know, you can buy really good saffron here for a very affordable price.
Where is the saffron grown?
It grows all over Spain. I'll tell you what, that's the one good thing the Moors did do. They brought that here, actually, from the Middle East or North Africa.
Well, the Moors also discovered coffee. Everyone forgets that the Arab conquistadors discovered coffee in Ethiopia. Everyone forgets that. That was another great addition to the world.
Chairman.
Thanks for listening in Spain. Michael in Spain, thank you very much. This is Michael Savage broadcasting to 400 or so radio stations, 380, 375, 400, who can count, on MPLS, multi-protocol label switching devices.
Savage. Visit TRNCentral.com, your one stop for news and all things talk radio. That's TRNCentral.com.
Warning, The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
Friday on the Savage Nation. There's a couple of things I want to say, then I'll go on to regular programming. If we don't defend our heroes, we're all doomed. We know about the insolence of office. We know how useless politicians are. But what you don't know is that the officers in the military are politicians, or they wouldn't be officers. The reason they rise to the top is because they're politicians. And as you know, the higher up the chain they go, the more useless they become for the average man in the field. In fact, the more anti-man in the field they become. You know, I did a whole show on Paths of Glory a year or so ago, when soldiers were actually sacrificed and executed for expedience by a French military officer in World War I, in that great book, Paths of Glory, and the great film with Kirk Douglas. What we have here is a Paths of Glory where this lieutenant is being persecuted because the top brass on the George Bush all the way down, you say, Bush? Yes, this happened under Bush. The same man who persecuted our Marines persecuted this man because of Bush's cowardice and incompetence and ineptitude. This man is now at Fort Leavenworth, and it's not going to end there. It's not ending. It's only beginning today. And I want to say this. I want to say this. I have a legal fund set up for me, but my vehicle is all set up. We got PayPal. It's got Visa, Master. You can go right to michaelsavage.com and make donations to the, you can go to the Savage Legal Fund and say for the Michael Behena Fund or for the military guy. But if you don't want to remember his name, go to the Savage Legal Fund. And let's say you're an older person and you don't use the computer and your heart is breaking right now. I know many of you want to help $10, $15, $25. I don't get a nickel. There's no overhead here. Not 10 cents is going to go to me. Savage Legal Fund, 110 Pacific Avenue, Box 135, San Fran, 94111. I'll read it only one more time. Savage Legal Fund, 110 Pacific Avenue, Box 135, San Fran, California, 94111. So send whatever you want and mark it for Lieutenant Behena. I'll send it directly to them. No overhead, no handling fees, no charges. I'm doing it because it's easier for all of us if it goes through there. It's easier. Now, if you went right to Behena's site and helped them directly, that's fine. I don't care. But I'm making it easy for the general listener. And now I'm going to read something to you about the insolence of office. And you have to go and understand that politicians have been around a long time. Officials have been around a long time. And they have hurt people for a long time. To be or not to be, that is the question. Whether it's to noble or in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, or to take arms against the sea of troubles and by opposing end them, to die, to sleep no more, and by a sleep to say we end the heartache and the thousand natural shocks that flesh is heir to. 'Tis a consummation devoutly to be wished for. To die, to sleep a chance to dream. Ha ha, there's the rub. For in that sleep of death, what dreams may come when we have shuffled off this mortal coil, must give us pause. There's the respect that makes calamity of so long life. For who would bear the whips and scorns of time, the oppressor's wrong, the proud man's contumely, the pangs of despised love, the law's delay, the insolence of office, and the spurns that patient merit of the unworthy takes, when he himself might his quietest make with a bare bodkin? Who would fardels bear to grunt and sweat under a weary life, but that the dread of something after death, the undiscovered country from whose bourne no traveler returns, puzzles the will and makes us rather bear those ills we have than to fly to others that we know not of. Thus conscience does make cowards of us all, and thus the native hue of resolution is sicklied over with the pale cast of thought, and enterprises of great pitch and moment with disregard their currents turn awry and lose the name of action. And that, my friends, is Hamlet's great soliloquy, to be or not to be, which many of you have heard probably once in your life and never understood. But I ask you right now, if you were his mother or you were him sitting in a jail cell in Leavenworth, Kansas, a jail cell filled with traitors, cowards, people who ran away from the battlefield, spies, the worst and the lowest vermin that this country has is in Fort Leavenworth. But you were a hero whose mother was a U.S. attorney and whose father is a special agent now for the FBI. And you went into the U.S. military wanting to help your country, wanting to fight for your nation. And then you go into an elite unit like the U.S. Army Rangers. And you go to a war zone instead of becoming a fat ass like another lawyer, another fat ass useless lawyer in the military, And you go over there and you do your job, and then you see your men killed by one of these Iraqi murderers, killed in a patrol. And then you're told to go out and round up the leaders. You round up the leader, you bring him in for questioning, and then the fat-ass military lawyers somewhere in Tampa, Florida, in between some hooker fest, in between some drunken drug orgy, some dumbass in Tampa, Florida with some badges above yours says, you know what, free him, we don't need this trouble. We don't want any more. The war is winding down. Bush is out. We want the Iraqi freed. And by the way, tell that schmuck who rounded him up to take him back. We'll show him who's in charge. We'll show him. Hey, honey, we'll be through. I'll be in a minute. We're going to get rid of this. And then the hooker masters down there in Tampa, Florida, in the CENTCOM command, wherever the hell they are, they go back to their lousy, useless lives, playing video games with cameras or looking at internet porn on the government dime. And this guy then has to take the murderer, the Iraqi, back And then he questions him to make sure he can find out where the other murderers are. The guy lunges at him during questioning and he shoots him. Now Lieutenant Behanna is behind bars himself, found guilty, given a life sentence, or with 35 years, whatever, in Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, and he's been forgotten. And were it not for my good friend Phil Brennan, who sent me the story last week, and the kindness of my audience, this man would probably be rotting there forever. Now, I want to conclude right now by saying his mother was on, and it was very touching. Here's a woman as a U.S. attorney who broke down on this show. She broke down. I made her tell the story the way it was. How would you feel if it was your son and he enlisted in the military and this was done to him by these louts in the U.S. military and the political structure that's less than worthless? How would you feel? After all, the guy went out and enlisted in the military to save America. And look what happened to him. We have to support him. So that's it. I'm not doing this for me. I'm not doing it for you. I'm doing it for him. I'm not looking to gain any brownie points with you. Oh, you're a great guy. I'm not doing it because I want you to say what a great guy I am. I don't want to hear those words. I'm nothing. He's the great guy. He needs your help, not me. So again, I'm going to conclude. Go to michaelsavage.com, look at the bottom of the page, make a donation, or send checks to Savage Legal Fund, 110 Pacific Avenue, Box 135, San Fran 94111. I will not take 1 cent, 1%, nothing, zero. Not 1% for overhead, zero. It all goes directly to them. We're going to help these parents climb back out of the hell they were put in by George Bush and the U.S. military. I went out on the boat today. Can I tell you, I never go out during the week. I'm a weekend boater. But I haven't been on my boat once since I went away to Florida. We're talking 6 weeks, 7 weeks now. The weather's been horrible. So there was a glimmer of sunshine where I live. The boat's down at the water a few miles away. I go down to the boat. It's absolutely London fog, pea soup. There wasn't 100 yards of visibility. It was so thick that I almost decided to can the trip. I go out in the fog. It was almost, as I say, no visibility. I'm talking not even 100 yards. But we get out of the harbor, and I decide, okay, I'm not going to turn towards San Francisco. I'll go toward the North Bay where the fog had burned off. I go about a mile, and I got to tell you, you want to talk about the hand of God? When you see the fog lifting off San Francisco Bay, and you see the sun come out, and you see the hills open up, and you see, well, you see what I'm saying. That, to me, is that's how I get in touch with nature and God. You know, God is nature's DNA. It's been said 100 different ways. I mean, how do you do it? How do you touch God? Some do it through a house of worship. God bless you. Some do it through ritual. God bless you. Some do it through nature. The object in all religion, as far as I'm concerned, is to do unto others as you have them do unto you. Or do not do unto others as you would not have them do unto you. I mean, whichever way you want to put it, negative, positive. All religions boil down to the same thing, except for one religion, which we won't name.
Savage.
The sewer pipe of Hollywood continues to pump out trash that rots the minds of our children. The worst movie I've seen in my adult life, Public Enemies, by Michael Mann, the TV director, starring Johnny Depp, the most overrated actor in history, in a movie that was so astonishingly horrible, I kept watching it to see if it could get worse, and it did. Couldn't understand half the dialogue because it was garbled. There was nothing there. Big deal. And who did they glorify? A bank robber and a cop killer. And if you're 11 years old and a moron, you sit, oh, he has a gun and makes him a tough guy. Oh, a tough man bangs another man over the head with a gun and shoots him. And you wonder why our children are screwed up. You wonder why our children are screwed up. Thank you, Universal. Thank you very much. As you can hear, the black helicopters are in the background coming to get me. Because this kind of truth is so dangerous in America that only anyway, we're also talking about religion, Hanukkah. I made a statement that has attracted some attention where I made a quote that only a revival of evangelical Christianity can save America. I mean every word of that. Then maybe we'll get decent movies. Maybe we'll get newspapers we can read again. Maybe your grandmother could walk to the grocery store for a carton of milk without fear of being raped. Not that the police aren't there to protect her, but they're afraid to protect her for fear of the ACLU, where the bottom of the barrel, scum of the earth, dictate the rules of engagement for the police. Same thing with our battles in Iraq and Afghanistan. Rules written by psychotic lawyers who have never fired a Daisy BB gun. And you wonder why the war goes on forever in Afghanistan. These are the topics. You are the caller. Any one of them is worthy of a comment. Let's begin in New York. Danny takes umbrage with my attack on Public Enemies. He thinks it's a great film. Danny, welcome to the program. Go ahead, please.
Michael, it's great to have you back. You have, without question, the most riveting show on the air. I'm a filmmaker in New York, not a Hollywood filmmaker. And I thought the film was very well made. I just disagree with you on the glorification of Dillinger. I didn't find that it glorified him. I just think it showed him as a major force that existed at that time period that America was fascinated with and still is.
Well, let me say this. You're a filmmaker and I'm not. I'm just a guy who watches movies on television, okay? Movies are made for an audience, and I think you are... Your being in the industry itself, you see a different movie than I do. And as a, in other words, you see the technique, you see various things done that I don't even know were done. You know what I'm saying? But the overall movie per se is about a bum, number one. Let me put it to you this way. Let's take The Godfather, admittedly one of the great gangster epics of all time. Why was it so popular? Because Don Corleone was not just a murderer who ordered the death of men, but he was also shown to be a man who had saving graces. He was judicious in the kind of violence he would met out. Remember that? In other words, remember when they come to him at the wedding and he says, well, they did this to my daughter, did that, and he gets Clemenza, get a man we can trust, you know, beat him up but don't kill him. Remember that? In other words, he was like a tribal leader, an ancient biblical tribal leader in the sense, even though he was a gangster, it was a guy reluctantly driven into the gangster world. He was a grocer, lost his job. He had to do it to serve the family. It's almost the same with The Sopranos, with the Tony Soprano. Although he's an all-around bad psychopath, the guy has some saving graces. Again, judicious sometimes with the use of violence. He could be kind to his family, even the guys who work for him. But this, there was nothing. There was no depth here with the character. If you want to just talk character, Danny, there was no depth. There was nothing. And as far as the girl goes, the lead, who is she? Why would they abuse this girl who was not even attractive, Marion Cotillard?
I disagree with you on that. I find her attractive. She won the Academy Award for playing a famous singer, Edith Piaf, in La Vie en Rose. And she.
I know Edith Piaf, but this girl doesn't do it for me. I don't understand it, by the way. But look, this is the whole point. It's art. Let's go back to the character himself. Why would Hollywood, with all this genius in Hollywood, they could have done a movie about so many great Americans who were violent, capable of taking on the enemy, bloodthirsty killers for the right reason rather than the wrong. Why doesn't Hollywood produce that anymore, Danny, do you think?
Well, I think you have a good point, but in the case of Dillinger, he is a fascinating character. He broke out of prison after 9 years and captivated a lot of the country at that time period of the Depression. And you did watch the film. That tells me that you were interested in the subject matter, were you not?
No. I like the genre of movies about such... In such scenes, I like to see the depth portrayed if there's something more to the character other than bloodthirsty murder and killing, and I didn't see it. Moreover, I got to tell you, I couldn't even hear half the dialogue. It was garbled. What was that all about? And incidentally, somebody in the lighting department hates Johnny Depp because they showed his pockmarked face. Why would they show all of the man's physical flaws in a movie?
Well, I can't answer the sound question. Michael Mann is a director who's devoted to complete authenticity. So he chose to only give you the sound that was captured on the set rather than people who go in a booth and loop, you know, and put in their dialogue.
I couldn't hear it. I tried to hear it. I thought I needed subtitles throughout the half the movie. And then the contrived love story, as I said. But the face, the lighting on the face made their faces, they both had very bad skin and pockmarks. Why would he do that to them, Danny?
Well, I think he went out of his way not to give them the usual Hollywood makeup treatment so they looked like they were real people that you could see with your own eyes.
Yeah, well, let me tell you something. I don't go to the movies to see real people. If I want to see real people, I go to a bad pizzeria. Thanks. Thanks for the call. We now have the Red Diaper Doper Babies running America, RDDBs. Red Diaper Doper Babies. Red Diaper Doper Babies. Red Diaper Babies, who then took dope. They'd like to put you into a mill and grind you up and spit you out. 30 million gone, and they have the perfect society, which is the society without any opposition that Harry Reid and Nancy Pelosi dream about. Quies custodiat ipsos custodes, pardon my Latin, I only know botanical Latin, and I'm after all only from the Bronx, so therefore give me a break, have some compassion for me. I'm not as bright as liberals who went to grade school. Quies custodiat ipsos custodes, Latin phrase from the Roman poet Juvenal, which says, who watches the watchmen, or who watches the watchers, or who will guard the guards, or who shall watch the watchers themselves? The answer is, not us. We can't. Quies custodiat ipsos custodes, who shall watch the watchers? The answer is, not us. Why, the media was supposed to do that. The media was supposed to do that. See, the media was supposed to watch the watchers. You see, the media is supposed to be the watchers of the watchers, but the media is a compliant group of gum. Think of gum. Think of Nutty Putty. Think of bouncing Nutty Putty. Then think of Tom Brokaw, and think of all of those in the media who are simply Nutty Putty in the hands of Bill Ayers and his friends. So who will guard the guards? Who shall watch the watchers themselves? The answer is, we the people. End of story. And the day you stop watching is the day they take over, and that's when the fun begins. That's when the fun begins. That's when the fun begins in this country, is when they take total power. If you think you've seen revolution in this country, you've seen nothing yet. You haven't seen what Bill Ayers and his friends would like to do to you. You haven't seen it? Go watch the movie about Cambodia. You'll get a closer view, a real close view. It won't be a movie. It'll be a snapshot of a mountain of skulls. Tom in New York, WOR, go ahead, please. What's on your mind?
Yeah, on June 9, 1970, I was in police headquarters when Bill Ayers put 15 sticks of dynamite in the second floor bathroom and blew up this whole second floor of police headquarters. And when I found out Obama was associated with him, I said, oh, my God, they're back in power again. It's like...
But, Tom, they're not back in power again. They now have the presidency. That man, every time he goes on Air Force One, I want to throw a brick through the screen. I say he's an imposter. He knows he doesn't belong there. He's faking it. He cannot believe it. He cannot believe it. He has Marines saluting him, a guy who's anti-military and anti-war. How is this possible?
It's possible because the American people don't realize when something walks like a red duck and it quacks like a red duck, it is a red duck.
Okay, we go on now. Marilyn in Florida. Next up, you're on the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
Good talking to you, Michael. I mean, they've control. They own our colleges and universities. They've been working at that for 40 years.
They worked the hearts and minds since the 1960s. I knew many of them. They were all very evil people. I knew the leftists. All they wanted to do was steal your dope and do your wife. They wanted to steal your girlfriend and steal your dope. They were degenerates. They were evil. They're now running virtually everything.
Exactly. When my son graduated with a double Ivy, his undergrad in Cornell, his graduate at UPenn, both in Near Eastern Studies, which means he studied Arabic. Do you know what his oral test was at UPenn? Wanting to know
No.
what his views were on, now what does abortion have to do with Arabic? Well, they're wanting to see if he is liberal or if he is right-wing.
He and studied Ryan, Arabic and the final exam was on abortion?
Wanting to know in his oral test, asking him in Arabic his views on abortion.
Now, wait a minute. In which university is this?
University of Pennsylvania.
The once great University of Pennsylvania.
Exactly, the once.
The great. Once great University of Pennsylvania, U of P, a once elite city on a hill, has now become nothing but a trash heap. And it was radicalized in the 1960s by the Bill Ayers, Van Jones type, the Jeff Jones types. They now run the universities, don't they?
Interested in wanting to know kids' political persuasion, to wanting to know what kind of grades they should get these kids. It's absolutely
It's
astounding.
Frightening. It's just frightening. Now we go to a man who knows a lot about communism. He calls the show on a regular basis. Jimmy in New York on WOR. You're on, Jimmy. Go ahead.
You're doing a great job, by the way. When you see that the communist world movement is winning massively in Latin America now, and they're spreading stronger and further in Latin America. Red China is penetrated all over Africa. You have the communist, I say, and you, I think you pretty much agree, too, takeover of America. When you add all this up, how could anybody still believe the propaganda from the KGB that we won the Cold War? That was a fake.
Well, you've been saying for years that it was a game that the KGB played, that when the wall came down, we said that the Soviet Union was broken. But I've always suspected that Gorbachev was a secret agent.
Exactly. But it's a mess.
When Gorbachev came to San Francisco with the Tides Foundation, do you remember those days?
Right.
Okay.
And at one of the things, they talked about excess population. So there is an organized movement to lower the population
of
the world.
Oh, God. Do you think they're capable of exterminating masses of people?
I think that there are people that would and can. Yes, I do. And you do it
Would there be enough will to stop them?
There'd have to be knowledge of it, because a lot of these things are done in a way where people don't understand until it's too late. There's still people giving Obama the benefit of the doubt. Would a person give somebody the benefit of the doubt if they're surrounded by Nazi war criminals and pro-Nazis and Klansmen? And you
right. In other words, let's say a conservative had won the election. That wouldn't have been McCain, because he was a stealth Democrat, planted the New World Order. He threw the election. We know that. But let's say there was a real conservative and he had won, and he created 40 positions for czars, and the czars had backgrounds with the KKK, neo-Nazis, etc. Tell me what the vermin in the media would be doing today, Jimmy.
They'd be trying to destroy him, but I tell you, the conservatives would destroy that person too, because conservatives would never allow that, no matter what party the person's in. We're not going to allow somebody to destroy this country. The left in this country don't have those same feelings that we do, the hard left, that is. Because I still think there are some decent liberals who are maybe misinformed.
All right, now let's stop right there. So let's get back to Obama. Where does he fall on the spectrum of communism? Where is he?
I think he's totally a communist. I call it Obamianism. Obamianism is when you bring black radicalism, radical Islam, communism, all kind of perversion. When you bring all the worst threats together under one movement, that's Obamianism. It's very clear to me from day one, he may have been conceived with the hope of becoming a communist president. I've known communists, and they've all been raised.
Well, I've read that conspiracy theory, Jimmy. I've read that with the father in Chicago, the whole conspiracy theory. But I'd rather not go there right now, because it would undermine your overall theme, in that the audience can only take so much and follow so much. Isn't that true?
Well, I think
that's for me to know, Jimmy. I'll be right back.
Lay across my big breast bed. Lay, lady, lay. Lay across my big breast bed.
This was big in its day. Remember, got a lot of people, really. He's quite a poet in his time. He'll be remembered in a positive way. Of all the 60s people, he's one of the best. I don't know what his politics are. I could care less. His music is incredible. His poetry is wonderful. Looks like a Jewish grandmother now. I don't understand that part of it. Like the physiology, the physiognomy has changed on his face. What is that about? It's like estrogens happen in a man over 60. You start to look like a woman. Nothing wrong with it. Not today. Not in today's world. But a lot of guys like become very effeminate after 60. They grow. I don't want to go there. Okay, it's a family show. But they change in appearance over the age of 60. And I saw that happen in Fiji once. It's not limited to white men. They get soft. They start to look grandmotherly. I remember I used to collect plants in the Fiji Islands, as you know. So I started going in 1969, long before the leftists even were born. And were taught they hated me. Many of them, the cyberbullies, weren't even born. But in 69, I was actually collecting plants, trying to do something positive for the environment. Most of the environmentalists don't actually do anything for the environment other than write about it. So I was in 69, 70, 71, in those years, collecting plants, recording them, blah, blah, blah. And I met the chief of a village, and I got to know him on every trip. I'd go back year in and year out. And he was a really noble, no, I was saying the noble savage. No, he was a noble-looking Fijian man, as men can look in societies like that, who eat well and lead a straight life. But as the years went on, when I went back toward the 80s, I came back, I was shocked one day. He was wearing like a red cloak of his wives, of his wife, or his wives, actually. I think they had a few wives. And he looked like a woman. I didn't understand the change that happened that way. Maybe when you get older, the two sides come together and you become a whole. You know, the yin-yang, the opposites thing become one. I don't know what it is. I just don't understand it. But that's neither here nor there. I was thinking about Bob Dylan for a minute, how he looks so much like a grandmotherly time. You make a Kanish or a gefilte fish. But he's still singing. They caught him walking around in Atlantic City. They thought he was homeless. It was sad. The cops didn't even know who he was, the young cops. You remember that story, Phil, from a few months ago? He was performing at like a floppy hotel in Atlantic City. I can't imagine what it'd be like in the 60s to be a god of entertainment. You know, really, like, there you are, cinema verite. They're running behind you, the Maisel brothers with the camera, the Maisel with the cameras, and Pennebaker does your movie. Everybody wants to be you. And now, like, click, 30 years later, you're playing, like, in a bad Atlantic City hotel, and you're walking around in your housing project in Atlantic City, and no one knows why you're there. Hello? And you're arrested, and the two cops don't know who you are. And the money's gone, basically, too. It's all about money. How long can you be on top? That's why I say it's better to have success come late in your life. If it comes early, what are you going to do? How long can you stay on top? Better it comes late. You want it when you're young because you want to lord it over your friends. There's no question about it. You want to, you know, to do the things. And, you know, yeah, let me help my friends. You don't want to help your friends. You want to boss them around with your money. When you get older, you're a little smarter about money, you know, what to do with it and what not to do with it and how to spend it and how to hide it and give it away and who to give, blah, 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 blah. But I'm just saying it's not good to make all that success, have success so young in life because you're not going to stay there. Almost nobody can. Rarely. Okay, rarely. Some do. But rare, very rare. Take a look at Dan Rather. He has a $70 million lawsuit against CBS. It's thrown out. It cost him $5 million, the lawsuit. Now, why was it dismissed? Why did they throw out, the court throw out Dan Rather's $70 million breach of contract suit against CBS? Because the court said the network continued to pay the anchor $6 million a year even after he left the evening news broadcast. And then the court said, you can't win on a breach contract, on a breach suit, because they were paying you. So there's a pay-or-play provision of the contract. The lawsuit is over, CBS said. It's done. But look at him, right? Rather is dumped by CBS in June of 06 after 44 years with the network. Why? Because he gave a fake report on Bush with the airline, whatever it was, military service. He went into it, said Bush wasn't in the National Guard, wasn't really, he was away, he was having a drink. He didn't actually fly the plane. The plane was flown by remote control. Bush was a drunkard somewhere in the toilet, getting high, whatever. Something like that. Along those lines, that was the implication for the lefty audience. So they threw him out. Because at that time, the country was conservative and in love with Bush. Somewhat. So it's over. Now he's 77 years old. You know what he does? Produces a news program for a cable channel you never heard of. Hiya. You know, I mean, this is what I'm talking about. How could you do that? How does he get up in the morning without shame? I often think about that. How could he do this? How do they not just die in shame? He was once one of the faces of America. Now he's got to wake up and listen to a guy like me and say, how in the world does he have such an audience? How in the world, when he talks like that, he speaks with such a New York accent, he doesn't give the news, he gives opinion, he gets paid for this. How is this possible? I'm Dan Rather. I'm Tom Brokaw. I think all the guys that grew up, where are they? You know, you can't stay on the top. Very few fields can you stay on the top, except in radio. You can hold on because your looks don't matter. No one knows what I look like, thank God. That's why I don't do any conferences anymore. No, that's not. No, it's a very private business, being in the radio. If you still have a good voice, you have brains and the guts to do it. You can stay in radio, you know, unless the political forces line up against you, which does happen, of course. So you find another way, where there's a will, there's a way. But, no, whatever. So there's Dan Rather. So there it is. That's the story. I believe that President Obama is not loyal to the United States of America nor to the U.S. Constitution, and I will continue my argument as follows. Obama floated the idea some time ago of creating a national police force, something that this country has not had ever since its creation. We have local police, we have military, we have FBI, we have a National Guard. Why would Obama even have suggested that he needs a police force, a national police force that reports only to him? Would you say that that is loyal to the U.S. Constitution? Well, there was another leader who needed a police force that was loyal only to him, even though the country had a military and the country had local police. That leader was named Adolf Hitler, and he wanted a police force that was 100% loyal only to him, and he created the SS, which was Hitler's private national police force. Why would Obama even suggest that he needs a national police force? Play the soundbite if you think I'm making this up.
We cannot continue to rely only on our military in order to achieve the national security objectives that we've set. We've got to have a civilian national security force that's just as powerful, just as strong, just as well funded.
Did you? I mean, you don't understand what's going on, most of you. You haven't any idea that we have a baby dictator here who would like to become an adult dictator, and how far he can go is up to how much resistance he meets, both in the Senate and in the streets. The fact of the matter is, he would like to go all the way if he could. He has said he is, quote, out to change the United States of America. So he appoints czars. He pushes through bills that are unconstitutional. He had a good friend named Bill Ayers who talked with bombs that he planted. Now, we try to warn you about Jeremiah Wright. We try to warn you about Bill Ayers, but many of you called us extremists. You thought that the man who planted bombs was not an extremist, but you felt those of us who pointed out what they did say and what they did do, that we were the extremists. Why? Because your mind is made of putty, nutty putty. Let's look at the rest of the reasons I say that Obama is not loyal to the Constitution nor patriotic. I'll continue my premise. He appointed czars. Some of them have praised enemy dictators who have killed millions of people like Mao Zedong. He has appointed people into the education department who are promoting sexual practices that are contrary to sane sexual practices, contrary to medical sanity, and contrary to the values of most Americans, whether they be Christian, Jewish, Muslim, Hindu, or Buddhist. Why is he doing that? Why would he put such a czar into the school system? And so you say, well, Obama may have missed investigating them. Why would you assume that Obama didn't know who these people were? Why would you assume he actually disagrees with them? He could fire them, after all, if he didn't agree with them. And so as I say to you, I believe President Obama is not patriotic. I believe President Obama does not believe in the U.S. Constitution. I believe the president has contempt for American values and traditions. I believe that the president will go all the way to becoming an adult dictator rather than the baby dictator that he is right now, unless you, the people, speak out and you, the people, act out through tea parties and through voting at this time. You must understand the danger we are in. Now, that is my premise, that Barack Hussein Obama has in fact lived up to the fears that we had about him at the beginning of this year and going back even into the campaign. You got to hand it to caffeine and chocolate, I got to tell you. And you, before a show, I mean, it's one of the great secrets. I don't sleep all night. It's like Agitationville. Maybe I look like Obama if I keep it up, all that weight loss. But I don't smoke. Why is he losing weight? Well, let's wish him well.
Savage. Visit TRNCentral.com, your one stop for news and all things talk radio. That's TRNCentral.com.
Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
Now,
America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage. You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
I drive into the city, go to this Chinese restaurant. Now, for one, the parking is enough to give you indigestion if you get there, and it's terrible, just awful. That already gives you indigestion. There's no point in going. So I get there. I've eaten there for 20 years, and they still mistreat us. It's just that I don't know if it's a nature of the business. They don't like me. It's racism. I don't know what it is. I can't tell. I get in there. I order a number of dishes, and I'm meeting a friend, and they bring us immediately the pot stickers and the steamed dim sum within 5 minutes. I said, well, tonight's going to be different. Now I'm three beers into the meal, and there are no dishes, and everyone who came in after me is eating. Eight times I get up, where's the food? Then they bring it out, and the rice is at the end, it was a mess, okay, a nightmare. I'm never going there again, but wait, the best is yet to come. My friend John, who's a philosophy professor, shows up a few minutes late, and he comes and he says, I had to park in a driveway around the corner. I hope I don't get a ticket. So right away, that's double anxiety. I don't blame him. There's no parking. Then he runs out 5 minutes later, and he puts a note in his windshield which says, please don't tell me. Call my cell phone number if you want me to move. Sure enough, in the middle of the meal, ring, ring. Oh, I'll be right out. I'll be right out. So I go out with him because John is a philosophy professor, and he's not street smart. I just had an instinct I better be with him. Sure enough, there's a crazed Russian in the street. He had parked not only in the guy's driveway, but right against the guy's bumper, and the Russian is insanely mad, screaming and yelling, you have no brains! No brains! No brains! No brains! Stupid, stupid, stupid brain! No brains! What, you have no brains? Why are you parking my car? And he's crazy. He's livid. Now, I know how to defuse street situations, and John, the philosophy professor, doesn't know anything about this kind of interchange. Everyone has their strengths and weaknesses. I'm trying to calm things down. I had four beers already. So I said to him, look, tell you what, just calm down. You have no brains! No. And he's screaming and yelling the Russian, no brains, stupid! And he's in everyone's face. So I said, this could escalate, turn very bad. You know, guns, knives, you don't know what's going to... Crazy relatives from the Ukraine could come out with tattoos from jail. You don't know where this is going to go. I'm trying to defuse it. So I'm saying to my friend, look, back the car up. I said, if there's any damage, I will pay you. I figured money talks, right? I wasn't saying it was anyone's fault. No brains. I don't care. Damage. No brains. No brains. And he's on and on with the no brains. I said, look, my friend is a philosophy professor. I don't care. No brains. Why on my car? So I said, John, back the car up. John backs the car up, and there's no damage whatsoever. So the Russian gets down on his knees. He says, no brains, stupid! No brains anyway! I don't care, damage, no damage, stupid, no brains! So I said, look, is there damage? If there's damage, I'll pay. No brains, stupid! Stupid man! I said, look, is there damage? And I'm saying, John, get in the car and get out of here. I'm going to take care of it. Go! And John doesn't go. John sits there and starts in with the guy, I want to see you smile. I said, oh my God. Now, the worst nightmare... You're telling an enraged Russian to smile? What does he think this is, a textbook in Marin County? He wants to see a smile out of an enraged Russian? He parked on his bumper? You know what that's like? That's like pulling out your private part and pressing it against his wife's jeans in the street. You know what I'm saying? You know what I'm saying? All right, look. I understand people expose themselves when drunk in Russia, but you don't touch wife's pants with private part. You get killed for this. It was the equivalent of, what are you parking against the guy's bumper for? It's bad enough to be in the driveway, but if you're going to park there, you don't put it on the guy's bumper. It was like a new car and little, and it looks like the guy worked all his life for his first new car. And to him, this was like a sexual encounter. It's like, all right, in my country, I know they get drunk and they pull it out, but they don't touch wife's pants. It was like on that level of insanity, the guy parked against his car. So I said, get out of here. And he's out of the car telling the guy, I want to see you smile. I figure a relative is going to come out and say, what you say to my uncle? Smile? In Russia, the worst insult, tell him to smile when he's angry. I mean, to me, it looked like it was going to blow up into World War III. So I said to him, get in the car and get out of here. No, not here. So again, telling the guy that he didn't mean it and he wants him to smile. So I said to him, and the guy's screaming, I don't understand America. American people, stupid. Stupid American people. So I said to him, I looked him in the eye and I said, but you like America, don't you? See, I knew how to turn the situation because I know in Russia a little bit about the Russian mind, which is that you can hate the person, but if you're a guest in another person's country, you don't hate the country because in his country you get killed for hating someone else's country or your own country. I mean, he knows from his own reversal that through history, if you say you hated Poland and there's a Polish man in the street drunk, he'll kill you. You see, I hate you, but I like Poland. It's a strange kind of Slavic sense of humor that you have to understand how to defuse these things. Hey, stupid friend, no brain. I hate Americans, stupid, don't understand them, but I love America. So it was like that kind of thing. Finally, it ended. So naturally, I'm never going to go back to that restaurant. That's all. You have to have been there. What I should have done is tape recorded this one. This would have been a beauty to have on tape recording.
Savage.
Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia. Indonesian woman jailed for almost cutting off her husband's penis over jealousy. A Malaysian court sentenced an Indonesian woman to prison for 6 months for almost severing her husband's penis out of jealousy, police said Wednesday. Umadat Setu, an Indonesian migrant worker living in Malaysia, pled guilty to court. Blah, 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 blah. Umada, a 47-year-old canteen operator, was arrested Sunday after her husband, who was also from Indonesia, filed a police report claiming she tried to cut off his penis with a knife. He received 11 stitches, blah, blah, blah. Muslim men in Malaysia are allowed to take up to four wives. It was not clear if Umida will... Four wives in Malaysia on the Muslim law? So what are they persecuting that poor guy in Utah for? I mean, he could have used the cultural defense if he wanted to. The dispute surfaced because Umida was jealous of another woman. Blah, 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 blah. Well, the guy's lucky that it occurred in Indonesia, not in Burma. I'll be right back.
Savage.
I'm a student of history, number one. The British got defeated in Afghanistan. We haven't learned from that experience. Do you remember the Russian military fought in Afghanistan? Do you remember how powerful the USSR was at the time? Do you have any recollection of the kind of weaponry they were able to bring onto that battlefield? Do you remember the images of those helicopters coming over a mountain pass? Maybe you saw them in movies. Now, you were an Afghani Taliban fighting against them. What would you feel? They were brave enough to stand up with, by the way, Stinger missiles given to them by the United States military. I should say the United States government gave the very men we're fighting now Stinger missiles to shoot down Russian helicopters. Well, today the Afghanis don't need American aid. They've got it from many, many other sources. Iran primarily, probably Russia. I'm not so sure. I don't know where they're getting their weapons. And so therefore I ask you, not only from the point of view strategically, can we win, but should we be there? Strategically, I don't know how we can win there. Where's the enemy? Who is the enemy? Who is the enemy in Afghanistan? Okay, first, let's define terms. We knew who the enemy was when the men were fighting against the Germans. Let's start with the obvious. It was the fascist Nazi party. They were identifiable. They were on a quest to rule the world and impose the Nazi ideology throughout the world. So when the men were fighting, although they were scared to death like every man who fights in war is, at least they knew what they were fighting for and who the enemy was. Can you say with any certainty that you know who the enemy is in Afghanistan and why we're fighting there? If you can, please help me understand it, because I don't. I don't know who the enemy is. Chicago, Illinois, Fred, welcome. You're on the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, you wrote a book saying that liberalism is a mental disease, and yet you've just vindicated everything they've said for the past decades since Vietnam. Everything you said is what the liberals have been saying for decades. This war.
So in other words, what? What are the liberals saying now, Fred, that makes them so brilliant?
What are they saying now? Well, so far is everything that you've said so far. And everything that you
Fred, please,
for.
You know, you're speaking in code words. What are liberals saying about Afghanistan now that you agree with so we can understand what you're saying?
We should get out. That's what they're saying.
We should get out. So why did Obama say we should get in?
Huh?
You heard me. Don't suddenly go half deaf on me. You just said liberals said we should get out. Obama said we should get in. So is he not a liberal?
I don't know if he's a liberal. I'm telling you what the liberal movement, the people who voted him in, wanted to get out of the war. That was one of the primary reasons we voted him in. The fact that he's turned his back on them, That's not unusual for any politician.
So how would the liberals, since you consider yourself one of them, and that's fine by me as long as you're willing to discuss your viewpoint, how would you face off a radical Islamic enemy that will not compromise, that will either kill you or convert you? How would you deal with them?
Well, the only way we could deal with them is to defend ourselves against them, which doesn't necessarily mean war. The thing is to step up our home, to say the things we've already done, step up our home defense, make sure our airports and everything is are guarded. How can you stop an idea? You can't stop it with a bullet. They're determined to kill us. The only thing you can do is defend yourself any way you can.
But let me ask you, Fred, rationally, do you think there is an Islamic militant Islamic threat against this country and against the West?
Oh, yeah, there is. There is terrible, hard feelings against us by radical Islamist groups. Yeah. They hate us.
Okay, so your idea is to withdraw the military and face them here through the FBI, through Homeland Security, but not to go to war with them anywhere.
If I thought the war would work, I would go to war, but it's like you said, it doesn't seem to be that a war is going to work. If you could show me where a war works.
Well, it's interesting to me that that leftists like yourself actually agree with me on this, which is not unexpected, because I predicted a few months ago that there would be an anti-war movement in America, but I also said it would be led by the right rather than the left, because it was the right now for quite a while that's been saying no to this war. It doesn't matter who began it, who ended it. What matters is that the military-industrial complex is behind it. I think we could agree on that as well, Fred, correct?
You bet. It is. It is. I agree with you.
Well, all right. All I can say is, Fred, I appreciate you listening so carefully. I disagree with you on some points, on others we agree. Now, this is very intriguing, ladies and gentlemen. Something just happened on this radio show that is historic in the history of radio. And I knew this day would come. I knew the day would come when the two ends of the political spectrum would suddenly see that they're saying the same thing on so many issues. Now, let's start with the most important issue there is, and that's life and death. Life and death issues are what we're talking about. This is not about making points on Obama, making points against Republicans, making points against liberals, or making points against conservatives. It is your neighbor's son who is going to go over there and be butchered to death in Afghanistan if he's caught by these animals. Let's make no mistake about it. What they did to the Russians, you still don't know. You still don't know what they did to the Russian boys that they caught, the 18-year-old blonde boys with blue eyes, the kind of tortures that they were subjected to. You're dealing with medieval throwbacks. They do not respect the Geneva Convention. They do not respect any convention. They respect only one thing, and that's a bullet. And they have a lot of them. They're being supplied by Iran and God knows who else. We have heavy equipment. We have heavy weapons, such as the Air Force, missiles. We're not going to use them. So already strategically, they have the advantage because they know the terrain. Let me repeat that. You don't have to be an armchair general to understand that I just made eminently good sense. What is our military advantage in? It's in hardware. It's in technology. So if you can't use the hardware and the technology in the form of cruise missiles, in the form of bunker-busting bombs, in the form of F-18 Hornets and the best trained pilots in the world, we have eight or nine aircraft carriers. I was aboard one 2 years ago. Doesn't make me an expert. I was impressed to find out that every one of our aircraft carriers has an air force on it larger than most nations on Earth. I didn't know that. In other words, the strike capacity of any aircraft carrier that the U.S. has is more powerful than the air force of most nations on Earth, single aircraft carrier. And we have them all over the world. Yet we will not be using our aircraft carriers in Afghanistan, will we? Now, why? Well, the why is the interesting part. Again, I want you to go back to geography. You know what the Himalayas are. You heard of Mount Everest, the highest mountain on Earth. The foothills of the Himalayas happen to begin on that side of the Earth in Afghanistan. They slowly climb up to those cloud levels in India. So how are our men going to fight in these deep canyons that have sucked entire brigades that have never been seen again? Russian brigades have gone in there and never came out of these mountain passes. Do I have to tell you about the Khyber Pass? Shall we read some poetry from the British colonial days? Look, you don't have to be a genius to understand this is not a flat plain war where you can enlist 1,000 tanks. It's a different form of warfare. That is why the enemy is so deeply rooted in that area. So that leaves us with very few options other than to put boots on the ground, so to speak. Although I don't like that phrase. It's not boots on the ground. It's Mrs. Smith's son on the ground. Do we have enough men trained in mountain warfare to go out there? He may say 30,000 men. Well, how many of those 30,000 men are trained in high-altitude fighting? How many of those men are as endurance-capable as the enemy who grew up in those mountains? We didn't hear any of that. I doubt that we will. So why are we in Afghanistan? Why are we in Afghanistan? I've been asking the question for a long time now. I don't have the answer for you. I keep hearing that if we don't defeat them there, it's going to create a vacuum into which Al-Qaeda and the other terrorist organizations will have a war cry. They'll come from around the world, and they will have a home base. Well, maybe that is true, but maybe that wouldn't be such a bad idea. Now, why do I say that? Because if they would all coalesce in Afghanistan, at least we could enlist our Air Force, our cruise missiles. We could unleash the arsenal that we have on all of the terrorists on Earth when they go to celebrate in their new homeland of Afghanistan. So I don't know that this policy is going to work to the detriment of Al-Qaeda. I think, in fact, it's going to encourage Al-Qaeda to keep sucking our young men into the meat grinder. Isn't it a world upside down? To those of you listening to my show, don't you feel as though it's Alice in Wonderland? We have a president in the White House who almost takes the side of the Fort Hood kilobyte. He didn't justify exactly what Hassan did, but he explains it away before the investigation has been done. First, they tell us they don't know why he did it. Now, they already reached the point of he acted because he cracked. How do they know he cracked when he screamed Allahu Akbar and was wearing the white holy robes when he did it? What do you mean he cracked? You mean anyone who says Allahu Akbar and wears a white robe is crazy? I didn't know that. That's an insult to Muslims, as far as I could tell.
Savage.
Visit TRNCentral.com, your one stop for news and all things talk radio. That's TRNCentral.com. You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
I'd like to ask you what you think is coming from Obama in the next few weeks. Now, I understand he wants to do things to the banks. He wants to overhaul the regulations of banks, the biggest overhaul since the 1930s. Many of you knee-jerk conservatives are saying, nay, no good, no overhaul. No, leave the good bankers alone. They know what they're doing. They need $16 billion in bonuses at Goldman Sachs. Well, now I got a little news for you. The banks need to be taken to the woodshed. They need a regulatory overhaul. I agree with Obama. Now, on that, I agree with Obama. Now, I don't care that you see it as anti-business. I don't care what the business people say. I know an awful lot about business, and I'm telling you, those boys on Wall Street not only should have an overhaul, they should be taken over the coals and be given a spanking. After all, we bailed them out. Now they're giving themselves $16 billion in bonuses? No, wrong. So in this one, I say the regulatory overhaul is good. You know, I've been as severe a critic of Obama's socialism as anybody in the radio business. In fact, you could say that I predated many in the business in seeing what he was and what he was going to do. But frankly, the banks need to be regulated. And I know many of you can't understand nuance, but the fact of the matter is he's right in wanting to overhaul Wall Street, the biggest overhaul since the 1930s. You have to understand that many of you are just feeding back the lies and the pap that are being put out by J.P. Morgan Chase, Goldman Sachs, and other banks through some of the so-called conservative loudmouths who don't really understand finance at all. I frankly do understand finance, and I am totally in favor of free markets, but there's no such thing as ultimate freedom in anything. In other words, total freedom is anarchy. Let me put it to you that way. Total freedom in any sector leads to anarchy. Take that, Mr. Obama, and run with it. I try to give McCain trickle-up poverty, didn't listen to me. Maybe you'll be smart enough to listen to me now that Massachusetts has come falling down. Yes, these crooks need to be regulated. Yes, they do. Now, why I am saying that is because I've actually studied the banking laws before the Great Depression, the banking laws after the Great Depression, the banking laws till Bill Clinton came to power and ripped them out and threw them away, the banking laws until Bush threw away what was left, and what happened since Clinton-Bush, and what we have to do now to fix it. And I say yes. I do not reject these proposals out of hand. I would like to see more details. And many of you say, well, Obama's just doing it because it's a populist message. No, I'm sorry. No, I believe that we have to go back to the 1929 stock market crash that ushered in the Glass-Steagall Act. The Glass-Steagall Act was a fabulous act, and it separated commercial and investment banking, which remained law until the Southerner came to power, Bill Clinton, until the man from Hope came to power. Hope again. Gee, two hopes in a row. The Glass-Steagall Act was put in, and it kept banks and investment banks separate. And that was law until 1999, when Bill Clinton evaporated that protection, that wall. And what happened as a result is there were mercilessly large, grotesque, obscene, pornographic profits and bonuses on Wall Street, and you paid for it. They were trading paper that had no substance whatsoever. They were creating fiduciary instruments that don't even exist. They made them up in order to trade them amongst themselves. And as I say to you, I believe that hedge funds need to be separated from banks in order to make riskier investments separate from the banks. You know, that's how I see it. The fact of the matter is I'm not alone in this. Some Republicans actually are taking a wait-and-see approach. Don't assume that all Republicans oppose regulating the banks to some extent. And please don't argue with me that we don't need any regulation. He's attacking capitalism. You don't understand what I'm talking about here. You got to understand there's more to this than meets the eye. That's my opinion. There are many, many intelligent people who see what's going on. But, now here's the but. You can't now rush down the road of everything Obama does is wrong. Because, look, the old joke, even a stopwatch is correct twice a day. I've said this before. Obama happens to be right in wanting to control the bankers. Never mind it's a populist notion. He's right. Taxing the banks is wrong. Let him tax Bonnie Frank and his friends' profits and Fannie and Freddie. Then I'll know that he's trying to be fair. But let's put taxation aside. We had a Glass-Steagall Act of 1933 that established the FDIC in the United States, which we all agree was wonderful. I remember when I was a little boy and I had my first bank account. I was one of these kids who actually had a paper out, worked in a luncheonette till midnight. I saved every nickel in Bankers Trust Company, and I used to love going there by bicycle and seeing my account when they'd add, you know, $2, $10. I felt like I was a rich man building my future. And then there was a strange thing added called interest, and I ran home and said, Dad, what's interest? He said, well, they give you money for holding your money. I said, why? How could they do that without losing money? I said, I thought that they just want to hold my money. He said, no, what they do is they take your money and they invest it, and they make money on it, and they give you some of that. I said, wow, what a great system. And it was a great system until Bill Clinton and Phil Graham destroyed it in 1999. You don't understand that this bill that was passed way back in the 30s, the Glass-Steagall Act, was meant to protect the average little guy. And it allowed the Federal Reserve to regulate interest rates and savings accounts, which was later repealed. But mainly it prohibited a bank holding company from owning other financial companies. That was repealed in 1999 by the Graham-Leach-Bliley Act and was signed by President Bill Clinton on November 12, 1999. So don't say it was Republicans or Democrats. Try to break out of that lockstep mentality and understand that money talks and democracy walks. Write it down. I said it first. When money talks, democracy walks. I don't care who's running it, you know. Now, let's not go to the fact that we don't need regulation. We need it. Regulation is communism. Don't be a fool. Please stop being naive. Would you like to overturn the child labor laws? I mean, we could do that, too. We could bring children in from Haiti and maybe rural India to work for you for 10 cents a day. Maybe that would also stimulate the economy. Let's get rid of the child labor laws next. After all, that's a law. That's a regulation. You don't need that. Get rid of the child labor laws. We don't need them. That's an evil socialist thing. Child labor laws now. I mean, you understand what I'm saying to you. It's rhetoric. The same way I've said rhetorical things that the morons in England took out of context. You know, unless you understand the context of what I just said, you can say Michael Savage said repeal the Child Labor Act. I didn't say that. Now, I have something to read to you. Remember about a year ago, starting in January, I read to you anonymous letters on the Savage Nation from an unknown magazine writer who wanted to interview me, and many of you said, don't do it, don't do it. And I kept reading his emails to me, remember? And it turned out to be The New Yorker, turned out to be Khalifa Sena. I invited him out to California, did an interview in May. It didn't run until, I think, September. I don't know when it came out. But I was very happy with it. I'm very pleased with it because it's balanced. By no means does it make me into a saint, but it doesn't make me into a devil. In other words, he didn't do a liberal hit piece on me. And I was very pleased with the result. In fact, I liked the cartoon so much, I printed up a couple of copies for all of my various studios. Because, A, I thought it was balanced and fair, as opposed to fair and balanced. And B, I grew up reading New Yorker profiles as well as the New York Times. And to me, it's a big damn deal to be profiled in the New Yorker. So I'm proud of it. Well, now this comes to me out of nowhere. Actually, it came to my web manager in Florida who forwarded it to me. And it came from an anonymous magazine. I'm going to read this to you while you're dialing and whiling. And it said, my email was bounced back, but here's what I'd like to know. Blank Magazine has asked me to conduct its legendary interview with Michael Savage, and I'm hoping you can connect me with him. As you may know, the interview is one of the last great long-form Q&As in journalism, 8,000 words, and it would give Michael a broad canvas to talk about life, liberty, and, well, anything else he cares to talk about. Happy to tell you more, but first wanted to make sure this is the best way to contact Michael Savage. Please let me know as soon as possible because we're coordinating our spring publishing schedule. And then he gives his name and blah, blah, blah. So he and I went back and forth yesterday in the rain, him in a car, me not in a car. I've lost the emails, but it ended with me getting angry, saying that was idiotic. When I asked him why, I first of all said to him, have you read the New Yorker interview? Yes, I've read it. I said, what did you think about it? So he said to me in an email, I think it made you look too sane. So I said, that's the most idiotic reply I've ever gotten. Why would I submit to an interview with you? Well, what are you playing the sane, insane game that I heard in New York in 1968? I said, you know, I mean, where are you coming from? What do you mean too sane? I said, do you think I earned a doctorate and wrote 25 books and built this media, the level in the media I'm at because I'm insane? So then he wrote back an apologetic letter, and here's the last email from him. I asked him, why do you want to interview me? And he said, finally, a moment to respond from an actual keyboard. I want to interview Michael because I can't think of another person out there better qualified to rattle the readers of this magazine. This will be a long, uncensored Q&A, the longest left in journalism. Oh, woe to us. To let you answer some big questions in your own words, not my verminy ones. I guess he listens to the show. He says, why has America fallen off track and how can it bounce back? Why won't a 43-inch plasma screen TV or a new Cadillac Escalade solve all my problems? What's really wrong with a little hedonism now and then? Why shouldn't we live life waiting for the great rewards of the afterlife? He says, I want to interview because I get sucked into your broadcast even when there's more important stuff to do, like picking up my 6-year-old from school, thank God he's married, and by the way, to a woman, or earning an actual living. And my guess is you'd be even more engaging in face-to-face conversation. And if not, then at least I'll be able to turn off the radio and get on with my life. So apparently he listens. Then he says, Savage, I'm interested in your past because I have a love affair with the Bronx of yore too, and also good jazz and newspapers that left print on your fingers. But I also want you to explore your vision of the present and the future so that you know the college kids and grandpas who flipped through this will understand there are points of view that don't fit neatly into categories like conservative. More than anything else, I want to give you the space, 8,000 words or so, to challenge our readers' expectations and entrenched views, to get people mad, to wake people up, and low to shake the foundations of the iconic magazine itself. Hey, Savage, if you really believe pornography and Hollywood stupidity, two of our favorite subjects, are weakening America, what better place to say that than in the pages of my magazine? You asked about the New Yorker profile. I admit that I love the New Yorker and actually wasn't surprised that it was a fair and nuanced piece. You came off as someone with real humanity and complexity, and that piece, which I read last summer and have been thinking about ever since, was what convinced me to reach out to you for an interview instead of just slacking off and streaming you on my computer. So please let me know your thoughts and your wife's thoughts and your listeners' thoughts and Teddy's thoughts. Thanks, blank. Question to the audience. Should I do this interview with this major publication? Yes or no?
Savage.
Good radio is good radio. A variety of the personality depends upon the personality. You could do politics till you're blue in the face and people would not listen to you. You could do it till you're blue in the face and they will listen to you, depending upon who you are in your delivery. But if I would only do politics, I would have left this business a long time ago. As I say to you, I am a communicator, and I've been brought up to admit what's going on inside me to people, you know, when I want to now. And certainly not everything. I mean, if I told you everything that was going on inside me or everything I did, I'd be crazy. That would be the mark of insanity. It's a public show. But I admit doubt. I admit pain. I admit grief. I admit failure. I don't think failure is dirty like a disease. I've had failure in my life. New York City, WOR. Tony, go ahead, please. You're on the Savage Nation.
Yes, Dr. Savage. Greetings from the armpit of America, New Jersey. Yep. I want you to explain to me, in all sincerity, and I have health care, so I don't care, but why is it that America can't get any kind of health care reform completed, but we have no problem getting into wars? I don't know.
All right. I can understand that question, and I have many answers to each question. I don't know where you are coming from, though. I suspect that you are an independent-minded guy who wants more fairness for the average person is sort of what I'm hearing. Is that right?
That's correct. Like I said, I have health insurance. I'll always have it, so it doesn't bother me either way. But, right.
Let's start with the health care issue. Massachusetts passed state-mandated health care in 1996. You're aware of that, right?
No, I wasn't aware, but I believe
right.
your word.
They passed it in 96, and take a guess what they were promised. They were promised lower premiums and better care, and take a guess what they got. They got massive fraud. They got massive health care for illegal aliens, non-citizens in Massachusetts. They had a $2 billion cost overrun, and they got worse care. So that answers part of the question, I think. You see, Tony, here's the problem with thinking these things through. Most people don't know that state-managed systems generally are more inefficient than privately managed systems. It's very appealing to say, you know, if the government ran something, they could do it for no profit, and it would be done more efficiently. But I thought about this in great detail because many people are confused about what a government can and cannot do. Let me give you an example. You take a look at our food supply in America. Admittedly, it's abundant, right? There's more food than anyone needs. Isn't that true?
That's true.
Okay, so we have the best food delivery system, the best food production system, the best packaging system, the best distribution system the world has ever seen. But there are excesses, right? You go to a dumpster outside a supermarket at the end of a day, you're going to find corn, you're going to find packaged goods, you're going to find meat, you're going to find poultry that's thrown out, right? So people would say, gee, that's waste. 25% of the food in America that's produced is thrown in the garbage, and that's because of the profit motivation or the profit system. If the government ran the food system, why, they would say, they would know how much corn to produce, they'd know how much meat to produce, they'd know how much wheat to produce, and there would be no excess, there'd be no food thrown in the gutter. Isn't that what you'd hear?
Yes.
What actually happened when the government ran food can be seen in, for example, the ex-Soviet Union. The ex-Soviet Union was a state-run, everything was run by the state. And so you had a butcher store with one salami in it. Because the bureaucrats who counted the number of people and the number of cows figured out that they only needed a few salamis to service the population. And they didn't care if there were lines of people waiting for the one salami for one reason. Because to a bureaucrat, people are not human beings, they're numbers. And so to them, it doesn't matter if a number goes hungry. It doesn't matter to them if a number is denied health care. It doesn't matter to them if a number cries out for better health care. All that matters is that it's a more efficient system. That's the difference between a state-run system and a private-run system. Now, is a private-run system perfect? No. Is it full of excess and greed? Yes. But the more people wind up with more things than they do under a state system, in my opinion, generally, yes. And that applies whether it's health care or food distribution or food manufacturing or the manufacturing of cars. Of course you're going to have cars that people don't want if they're made by a private corporation. They'll take a chance. That's what capitalism requires. You take a chance. You build a product. If the people want it, they buy it. If they don't, you're stuck with it. So you say, gee, that's inefficient. Look at all of the waste of cars. What if Obama put out a single car called the Marx? Or what if he put out a single car called the Carl? And everyone had to drive this little red car called the Carl. Well, you wouldn't have any wasted machinery. You wouldn't have any wasted metal, no wasted tires. Everybody who wanted a car could only buy a car through the state, and it would be run by the government. And everyone would have the same red car called the Carl. Is that something that you think America wants?
No.
No, well, that's what you're going to get in the healthcare system. It's a little red car called Carl, devised by Nancy Pelosi, Harry Reid, and Obama. They want everybody driving a little red clown car called Carl, and that's what they have in mind for healthcare. Now, with regard to wars, that's very interesting. Are we at war in Afghanistan because we need to be, or because the government, the military-industrial complex, wants a permanent war with Islamic fascism? Is Islamic fascism as dangerous as we are?